Storyworthy Media, the best in story-driven content.
Hi, this is Matt Oswald, and you're listening to Storyworthy, while Christine Blackburn's giving me a handjob under the table.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Wondery Sunset Studio in West Hollywood, California. I am so glad you tuned in today. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Today's story is brought to us from writer Matt Oswald. And let me just tell you something, you guys. Not only is Matt a fantastic writer, he's an amazing tennis player. And this I know, because we play tennis all the time. But let me say this about the story tonight. Matt is just incredibly smart, okay? And he is able to put words together in such a way that is like always impactful, always clever, and just flat out hilarious. Now, if you follow him over on Twitter at Matt Oswald VA, the VA stands for Virginia, by the way, that's where he's from, then you know what I mean. Now, in today's story, Matt talks about working as a page at NBC, the old NBC, like over in Burbank, where The Tonight Show shot for years and years and years and years. Now, I was a page at Paramount Studios when I first got to LA. That was actually my second job. My first job was giving tours of the movie stars' homes in Beverly Hills. I'm not kidding. And there I primarily learned that the stars don't really live in Beverly Hills anymore. I think they live more in Malibu, right? Or like the hills. Anyway, coming from Pittsburgh, like I didn't know anything about Hollywood. So when I started working at Paramount, like I really did get an education. I had never been on a soundstage before I got to LA. You know, I didn't know how any of it worked. So working as a page, especially at Paramount, was, you know, really good for me. I learned a lot. And by the way, if you've never been to LA and you're coming, or the next time you come, I strongly recommend you take a studio tour. I think Warner Brothers, they still have got tours. And of course, Paramount still has tours as well. So you guys got to get yourself on a studio tour. Okay, you guys, before we get to the story, I did want to remind you to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Storyworthy. And why not head over to my website, storyworthypodcast.com, before you shop on Amazon? Because that always helps, right? You click on that ad, you shop as normal, nobody gets hurt. But I get a few pennies, you see? So it all works out. Let's do that.
You know, the more interested we are in the world, the more interesting we become. Discover stories, including one about a secret underground city that will reveal sides to the world you'd never expect. For instance, historian Donald Miller tells a true story from intercontinental New York Barclays past, an underground city from the 1930s, where guests once strolled, shopped, and met friends in beautiful subterranean passageways. These stories are so good, we created a special place for them at the end of this episode, so make sure you stay tuned and listen until the end. Download the stories of the Intercontinental Life, Fascination Audio on iTunes, by searching for Intercontinental Hotels. With Intercontinental Hotels and Resorts, every moment is a chance to be fascinated. Discover more stories at intercontinental.com/life. You guys are going to love these stories.
Okay, you guys, enjoy this story. I was a page at NBC from Matt Oswald. And you can find Matt, like I said, on Twitter at Matt Oswald VA. Without further ado, folks, the one, the only Matt Oswald.
My first job when I moved to Los Angeles was an NBC page. I walked around the Burbank lot in suffocating polyester slacks and coat, leading groups of drooling bumpkins on tours of the costume department, empty studios where they might see a janitor rubbing himself in his private region. Yep, that happened. Or even get a chance to take a snapshot of Jay Leno's parking spot. You shut out $8, so snap away, Hawks. So one summer day, I meet a small group of hayseeds too cheap to go to Legoland. I ask where they're from. Arkansas! Of course you are. Let's go. I casually mention the studios we'll be passing by. Leno, the old Carson studio, later with Greg Kinnear. Yeah, that long ago. And, of course, Days of Our Lives. And on that, I heard a down-to-earth, goodness-to-gracious squeal of delight come from a pasty heifer clutching a Days of Our Lives mug like it was a Bible with a bow around it made of Twizzlers. Quick backstory. As a page, I also worked the NBC gift shop. Seinfeld merch, Friends merch, Leno merch. Hell yeah, we sold the shit out of it. Days of Our Lives merch, not so much. I remember a stack of DOOL mugs behind the counter we dusted once a week from such little movement. For all I know, they're still there next to some moth-eaten Whitney shirts. But this woman was a Days of Our Lives fan and damn happy to be there. I asked her to name some characters and she rattled them off. In that moment, as she stood there vibrating with glee next to her dumpy husband and two dumpy kids, I saw her entire life. A trailer strewn with toys and dirty laundry, her flaccid husband on an IKEA sofa watching wrestling, Saturday trips to Walmart, long waits at the checkout line searching for coupons, and idle fantasies about drowning her kids in a bathtub before braining her husband with a frying pan. And during all of this, to spend one solitary hour a day transported to the fictional soap opera town of Salem, having toured affairs with handsome-faced and long-dicked men, cocktail parties with a society woman whose lives encompass all the drama and passion she so desperately yearns for. And the best part was, I could actually help her out. Very few times in my life have I had the power to make someone's dreams come true, but on this occasion, I could be her champion. The tour began between the Days of Our Lives studio and the cast parking lot, so there was a very, very good chance we'd see a star. And even better news, the cast were the nicest people ever. They would always stop, say hello, sign autographs, pose for pictures. Every Friday, they'd have a big ice cream bar and invite us pages over for free scoops. They were total sweethearts, except one, Deidre Hall, the patriarch. She was the face of the show, at least when I was there, and she was not a nice woman. She would always walk, sunglasses on, head down, never look at you, even if you said hello. I don't know if she was mean or shy or just a dedicated actor always in character, but she creeped all of us out, and we knew to keep a wide berth. Even on the odd times we caught Leno walking by, he'd stop for at least a second, but Deidre was not a people person. That said, I rarely saw her, so I wasn't too worried. I was banking on one of the young hunks to walk by, be the thrill of this woman's life. I led our tour past the Days of Our Lives studio. I lingered longer than I usually do, hoping for some action. I watched the woman reach out and touch the massive soundstage door. She did it slowly, as if trying to convince herself this was real. She was in Salem. This exists. I'm alive. Then it happened. Down the long, narrow corridor that led to the dressing rooms, I saw a door open and Miss Deidre Hall, Electra woman herself, step into the hallway and walk towards us. I stood there, soaking up the joy on this woman's face as she watched, mouth open, as her idol approached. Reputation or not, I had never bumped into Deidre when I was with a tour. Surely she didn't treat the commoners as badly as his lowly pages. Here was a bona fide fan holding a Days of Our Lives mug, for Christ's sake. Of course she'll stop. About 20 feet away, the woman cried out, "Oh, Marlena!" Side note, Deidre Hall played Dr. Marlena Evans on the show. Yeah, I didn't know either. Deidre stopped cold as she heard her name. For maybe a second, she glared at all of us. A cold death stare. Her giant sunglasses making it all the more sinister. And without a gesture, she made an about-face and double-timed it back to the studio, the door slamming behind her. It was over. The woman was frozen in her tracks. She looked from me, then back down the hallway like a puppy who's been dropped off at a kennel by an owner grown tired of it. It took me all of a half second to realize what just happened. But for the woman, maybe a full 10 seconds for her GED-level brain to work it out. And when it did, her face sank. It was immediate and absolute, and it was the saddest thing I've ever witnessed in my life. I wanted to walk down the hallway, grab Deidre in the headlock, and make her apologize, but I didn't. After a long pause, all I could think to say was, "So, anyone want to see where they filmed CPO Sharky?" For the next 45 minutes, I stumbled through the history of costumes, sets, the Johnny Carson studio, but I could not take my eyes off this poor creature who followed silently, ever so often glancing back as if waiting for Deidre Hall to come running up and take her by the hand into Salem where adventure and men with pulses lived. And the look on her face of total confusion never went away. For 45 minutes, "What had I done to Dr. Evans? Did I say something wrong, Dr. Evans? Did I insult you, Dr. Evans? Why, Dr. Evans?" A million questions and nobody to answer them. Not surprisingly, her husband and two kids seemed oblivious. They lumbered along happily, smelling of tacos. The tour came to an end, and I bid them farewell. Her husband asked which way to the Bob's Big Boy, and I showed him. I watched her walk to the rental car, her mug lazily dangling from her chubby fingers. Her kids could have walked in front of a bus, and she wouldn't have given two shits. She took her first steps into a larger world that day, but unlike Luke Skywalker, there was no happy ending in Endor. It's been over 15 years since this happened, yet not a month goes by I don't recall the woman's expression when Deidre shunned her. You know, everyone has a moment that vividly stays with them. I wish I had a tale like Mr. Bernstein from Citizen Kane, always thinking of the woman he saw for only a brief moment on a ferry. But I suppose with my morbid persona, it makes sense this memory is the one I replay the most. I like to think this woman returned to Arkansas, tossed the TV, cleaned up her life, maybe took some college courses and bettered herself. But I fear she's still in that forsaken trailer, lying awake at night under a blanket, just her and 1,000 Oreo crumbs, replaying the encounter with Deidre Hall over and over. I suspect the Days of Our Live mug sits in the back of a cupboard, unused, the price tag still on it. By the way, they don't give NBC studio tours in Burbank anymore. I'm glad. They cause nothing but pain.
Okay, so listen, that was sad, right? I mean, it was. It was really sad. That show, by the way, Days of Our Lives, that started in 1965. Can you believe that? And it continues to air. Seriously, almost daily, even today. They have over, are you ready? Over 13,000 episodes. Can you believe that? And like I said, the Burbank Studios now, those tours ended like in 2012. And the Tonight Show moved back to New York. And now I think it's a real estate group owns it. Anyway, it's all history. But at least we have Matt's story, right? All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up right about now. I want to thank our storyteller once again, Matt Oswalt. Matt, thank you. Please let me win in tennis next time. Pretty please? You guys can find Matt, like I said, over on Twitter at MattOswaltVA. And why not tweet him and let him know how much you enjoyed his story today on Storyworthy. And you can follow me over there as well at Storyworthy. Join us next week on Storyworthy for a story by Vito Lapacola called How Elmore Leonard Saved My Life.
I realized I was going to have to fight. And so what I did was I reached my arms out. I got a good space of like where my reach was. And I made it up in my mind that the first man to get close to me, no matter if he was going to say, hey, Holmes, you got a light? Hey, man, do you know the way to? I didn't care what was going to be said. I was going to punch him as fast as I could and as hard as I could and as brutal as I could and see what happened.
Again, don't miss this incredibly well-told story by Vito Lapacola next week on Storyworthy. All right, I want to thank everybody here over at Wondery today, including our sound engineer, Sergio Enriquez. And on behalf of our storyteller today, my friend and foe, Matt Oswalt, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week. No bagel!
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
Okay, you guys, stay tuned, because right now, you're about to take a multi-sensory journey into the intercontinental life, and you'll discover stories that will excite your curiosity, broaden your mind, and take your imagination to places you'd never expect. Live the intercontinental life. Enjoy.
This is Stories of the Intercontinental Life. I'm your host, Paul Pensner. Butterflies. Bicycling, jazz singers from the 1930s, how to make the perfect cup of coffee. We all have fascinations. Sometimes they're very specific. But where do our fascinations originate? Why do we devote so much time to these interests that to other people seem totally random? Well, Today we hear three stories about fascination and experience what it feels like to be captivated. Our first story begins in the Intercontinental New York Barclay Hotel, through the revolving doors that look like a birdcage, with silhouettes of warblers on the glass, into the newly renovated lobby. Our reporter, Bianca Gaver, takes it from here.
I'm standing in the lobby, but our story begins underneath the lobby, where a spiral staircase leads to a secret tunnel. The tunnel travels from Grand Central Terminal, the iconic train station in the heart of Manhattan, to this hotel. There's a door in the hotel lobby that leads to the tunnel, but staff aren't allowed to open it. I wanted to know what this tunnel was used for and why it had been abandoned. So I tracked down someone who could tell me more.
It wasn't called a tunnel, but an underground passageway.
That's Donald Miller. He's a best-selling author, professor of history at Lafayette College, and a historical consultant for TV and movies. He's also fascinated with the 1920s.
Let's say you're coming in from Chicago, and you're going to go to the Barclay. There would be a passageway that could take you right there. These passageways have gone kind of into disrepair, but they were pretty cool then. They were lined with really exclusive shops, jewelry shops, buy a hat, a dress, things like that.
According to Donald, the story of the tunnel starts with Grand Central Station, which experienced radical changes at the turn of the 20th century.
A guy named William Wilgus was a chief engineer, and he's a genius behind this whole project.
Before Wilgus came along, the area around Grand Central Station was a big dusty rail yard. Wilgus had the idea to move the trains underground, and the tracks were electrified, a novelty at that time. This was quite a change from the way Grand Central used to be.
Where's all the noise and confusion and smoke and, you know, and everything else? People didn't even think they were in a train yard when they came in Grand Central because the train was so quiet.
But redesigning the tracks was only part of Wilgus's vision.
He said, we'll suppress the tracks, but we'll do more than that. We'll build above the tracks an entirely new mini-city within the city of New York called Terminal City.
Complete with luxury shops, movie theaters, and a new opera house. And of course, Terminal City would need to offer some of the world's best hotels to host the thousands of new visitors streaming into Grand Central.
And the Barclay Hotel is part of that.
So what was the deal with the tunnels? Wilgus wanted travelers to walk to their hotel, sheltered from the chaos and weather outdoors. And they could experience the luxury Terminal City had to offer along the way. He designed a series of passageways that connected the train platforms, subway stations, and nearby buildings.
And that's what made New York Central so spectacular to a lot of people. I mean, it's the gateway to the city. And you get a sense, like it's a metaphor for the city. If this city works as well as the station works, so efficiently, with all the beauty of the station, and it's a sunny day, and you know, those cathedral windows, you know, the sunbeams coming through. And it's pretty impressive. You not only have a new city in the sky, but you've got a city below the city, and all these places are interconnected.
The improvement of Grand Central and the new buildings in Terminal City led to a boom in the area.
They were throwing up skyscrapers literally by every week. To live in New York then was, one, to live literally on a construction site, but also a construction site where the future was being built.
So walk me through it. Say you're staying at the Intercontinental New York Barclay Hotel, and you pull up into Grand Central, and your train comes in.
Your luggage was dropped off earlier, taken by porters to the Barclay. Put in your room. They would even unpack it for you. Your stuff would be hanged in the room. A bottle of champagne waiting for you. Concierge would handle everything. And people were just agog.
The hotel became an iconic location.
And celebrities would stay there. Ernest Hemingway had a very famous interview there with his wife-to-be, Margaret Gellhorn. He was writing For Whom the Bell Tolls.
But most notable of all was the birdcage.
You know, the hotel had a birdcage. They put it in 1945. They had piano music, and the birds would chime into the piano music. And then they had a policy where they would allow guests to bring their birds with them.
According to hotel records, there was a time each day when the birds were allowed to fly freely in the lobby. A room full of birds flying around seems like paradise to me. So I asked Donald, at the end of our time together, were the 1920s really all they're cracked up to be? Could the level of glamour I'd read about in The Great Gatsby really exist? And his answer, flat out, was yes. But then the Great Depression hit, and the decadence and excitement of the 20s came to an end. The underground tunnels in Terminal City fell out of use and were left abandoned. I asked Donald why we don't have the luxurious tunnels and birds in the lobby anymore. He answered jokingly,
"We've lost our sense of how to live." We really have.
That's what I've come here to learn.
Yeah. We really have.
Back in the hotel, I admired the lobby, certainly one of the finest available in my lifetime. Guests were resting on couches, talking with friends, and laughing quietly. I made my way back out the revolving doors, still as splendid as ever.
You've been listening to Stories of the Intercontinental Life, presented by Intercontinental Hotels and Resorts. For over 70 years, in more than 180 locations around the world, Intercontinental has been the doorway to luxury travel as it should be. To hear the rest of this episode, and to discover more stories of the Intercontinental Life, visit intercontinental.com/life. Thanks for listening.